It's a more interesting than even I thought it was going to be. So this is really a very interesting area. So our next speaker is Deborah Nair. She's a professor and chair at the University of Vermont in the Department of Plant and Soil Science. She's an ecologist, soil ecologist, and looking at the biological interaction related in complex agricultural forest and wetland systems. So she's going to be speaking on how nematodes and microarthropods really continue this interaction with the plant systems and the bacteria.
Right. Much of the phytobiome work has really, you know, we've really focused a lot on the microbes, but I'm hoping to make the case for looking up the trophic chain, a link or two. And so that'll be kind of the focus of my talk today. Biological indicators are really underrepresented in many of our environmental monitoring programs. If they are included, it's usually limited to microbes, or organic matter, carbon, or some metric thereof. The downside is that, I mean, they're important, but it's also very difficult to interpret at that level because there's tremendous variability both in time and space. And I think it makes sense for us to move up the food chain to secondary, tertiary, quaternary consumers. They have the advantage of integrating everything, all the information that's going on below them in the food chain, as well as integrating information about the soil biology and chemistry. And if we get into these groups, then we have a chance to get at kind of the top or keystone predators. That's often been a goal for ecologists, thinking of those as kind of being the ultimate indicators of disturbance. Multiple agencies have been trying to develop indicators for environmental monitoring over the last two decades. And when it comes to the microscopic world, I often hear, especially if you're trying to pitch this to a politician for more funding, they say, well, why do we care? They're certainly not because they're easy to do. It's not, nor do they, most people think, the politicians think they're very charismatic. And I just picked out a couple examples. Do you think they would think those are charismatic? But, you know, what they really care about is, do our soils function? Do they work? So what we want to do is to convince them is that these are good measures of soil function and that we're using those as measures of the soil function. We can just secretly keep in mind that we think they're very charismatic. So the two functions I'm going to focus on that the soil invertebrates link well with our nitrogen mineralization and decomposition in soil. So when I was first starting in this field in early 1990s and working with some of these agencies, I interacted with a lot of soil chemists and physicists, and I agreed with them that there's correlations between chemistry, physical properties, and the biology. And I also agreed with them that some of those measures are easier and faster than doing the biology. And so they said, well, if they're correlated, why even bother? So I took it on to do some quantitative assessment. And what I discovered is that really only the soil properties, and if we just focus on the microbial biomass, they're only predicting about 23% of the variation that's in the soil invertebrate community. So indeed, those invertebrates are telling us something different, and there's good reason to include those in addition to these other indicators. One of the most commonly used indicators is a diversity index. It's a mathematical calculation. I've illustrated some here for a kind of a cross-ecosystem study that I did in different and comparing relatively undisturbed and disturbed members or versions of each of those ecosystems. Now, in all of these cases, the community composition was really different between the relatively disturbed and undisturbed, no matter what kind of ecosystem. But the diversity index was not able to detect a difference between the levels of disturbance. So the community composition is different, but the thing is the diversity index does not contain or maintain that information about the taxon identity. So I haven't found diversity indices to be, we have to be careful on those. Another approach would be to look at process. And if we wanted to just simply look at decomposition rate as a process to see if our soils were functioning. The slopes on these lines are the rate, which refers to the rate of decomposition. And on the left is a cellulose, 100% cellulose substrate. And on the right is a mixture of cellulose and lignin. The different line styles represent the relatively disturbed and undisturbed. There are different forest stages. Basically, there's no significant difference in the rates between the disturbed and the undisturbed forests in the decomposition rate. However, the community composition differs greatly. So I'm not finding that process really works has worked that well either. This has led us to consider other types of indices and that describe community composition and maintain that information and tell us something about ecological function. And I would contend that indices that relate to ecological succession are more reliable in detecting relative disturbance. So at the top is an illustration with plants. I think that's often how we begin learning about succession. But the concept here would be in the first type of index that it would be a weighted mean, looking at relative abundance, of organisms that have life history characteristics associated with early colonization versus, and you have a continuum of numbers, with those that have life history characteristics associated with late successional species. And we generally think of the early successional or the R strategist as being relatively tolerant of disturbance, and those that are at the later stages of succession to be more sensitive to disturbance. The second approach with fungivore to bacterivores is kind of, in a sense, I put it in that this family of successional. But it's focusing on more the decomposition community, looking at fungivores and bacterivores. And in succession, usually fungivores come in later than bacterivores. So the idea with either form of these successional indices, these families, I see that, you know, in both cases, the values, as the values decrease, that suggests we have more disturbance. Higher values mean healthier soils. Of course, there's the caveat of, they always say, you know, according to what? Depends on what your use of this soil is. Illustrated here is some results of a regional survey work that I did with the National Agricultural Statistics Service using their area frame design. And these represent cumulative distribution functions, and it has the maturity type of successional index on the top and the fungivore to bacterivore type on the bottom. Each of those line styles represents basically soil of the same type that either contains a annual crop or a perennial crop. For both of these indices, we see that there's a greater proportion of the land area under the curves, under the curves have lower index values in the annual than the perennial cropping systems. So there's more of the land with lower index values under the annual than the perennial, suggesting that the perennial system has, you know, more complex later successional soils, if you wanted to say healthier, than the annual system. So the disturbance type in this case, the focus we were trying to do was on cultivation. And in this case, the perennial crops were in systems that had not been cultivated for 10 or more years. Recently, I've had a chance to work in a pasture that hadn't been cultivated for over 100 years. We looked at this in my soil ecology class last spring. So, interesting feature that we found about was this little protozoan over there in the right-hand side. We found in the soils that had not been cultivated for a century contained this particular species of protozoa, the Vorticella. After that site had been cultivated one time, it was no longer there. That's a pretty sensitive indicator. Maybe a little too sensitive, but it definitely suggests that protozoa are telling us something about that. Now, if we looked at the nematode communities in that soil, just between zero tillage with the 100-year or just a single tillage event, we see some patterns where the enrichment bacterivores within the nematode community are increasing in abundance, and we're seeing relative decreases in the fungivores and the basal bacterivores, so kind of moving to an earlier stage of succession. Taking us out to a different ecosystem, looking at deserts, this is in southeast Utah, the field site here, we wanted to see what effect climate change, in particular abiotic effects, have on nematode, protozoa, and microarthropod communities. The treatments imposed were at elevated temperature, increased summer precipitation, or the interaction, both of those. I'll tell you right now, the microarthropod community composition did not change much with these treatments in 3 years. Doesn't mean it won't, but not in 3 years. In contrast, if we look at numbers of the protozoan nematode community, we saw some dynamic results. It's kind of a busy slide. However, because it's representing three different groups of protozoa, on the upper left are amoeba, flagellates on the lower left, ciliates on the lower right, nematodes on the upper right. And as you have all the treatments represented, as they get the bars get darker, is progression of time. I want you to focus on the orange bars, which are the most intense or severe treatment, which has the increased moisture and temperature, the most stressful situation. If you look across those bars through time, you see in the amoeba, you see there's actually an increase through time with that stress. In contrast, the others all tend to have a decrease. The other groups of protozoa decrease and the nematodes decrease. We're seeing in this case that it appears that the amoeba are actually better tolerating the abiotic stress of the elevated temperatures and precipitation than are the nematodes or the other groups. So just another pitch for protozoa maybe being a potential indicator, but maybe, you know, in terms of their responding to disturbance. We certainly can conclude from so far in my talk that soil invertebrates do respond to disturbance and change. The next phase of my work was to really try to link indicators with the ecosystem function to see if they were really quantifying that relationship and trying to understand what spatial scale that we needed to calibrate these at, you know, where we needed that reference base. So this was a statewide survey that we looked at three ecoregions. So the mountain, the Piedmont, and the coastal plain, each of those colored counties is the county that was selected. Within each of those are six sites. There are three ecosystems all within the same watershed. And then there's pairs of relatively disturbed and undisturbed of each type of ecosystem that are matched by soil type and monitored through time. In this experiment, we looked at two major groups of organisms, the microarthropods and the nematode communities. We looked at two major processes, decomposition rate and net nitrogen mineralization. By net nitrogen mineralization, I mean available ammonium and nitrate. So the approach I used to quantify the relationship between the function and the organisms was a canonical correlation analysis. It's a multivariate approach, and you can see the bars on the lower, on the left side here. On the y-axis is the percentage of the, in this case, nitrate and ammonium explained by the nematode community composition. On the x-axis are the lag time between the samples. So if it's zero, they were measured at the same time. But what you can see is the bars are taller at the 0-2, so if the lag time of nematodes, and then looking at available nitrogen 2 months later. So the two, I'm going to focus on the two that have the stars there. The best relationship is there at this lag time of 2 months, and it's the correlation between these is better if we keep analyze the relatively undisturbed separately from disturbed than if we pool those two together. And we see that the linkage is a little bit tighter for the undisturbed, for the older forests, than it is the younger, 13% to 22% explained of the nematodes of available nitrogen. About half of that in the relatively young forests. I would hypothesize that's just related to the time of adaptation that might be occurring in those soils, but that would require further observations. So what is the mechanism for linking nematodes with nitrogen mineralization? Nematodes can contribute it directly by excreting ammonium and indirectly by grazing as well as dispersing microbes on their bodies. Now in this study, we did not look at the protozoa, but I would anticipate that they would be contributors because we know from the literature that protozoa and bacterial feeding nematodes are the two groups that are expected to account for the majority of the faunal contribution to nitrogen mineralization. And in these moist forest soils, protozoa are notoriously abundant. So I like to just keep protozoa in the back of my mind. Microarthropods linked best in this study to the rate of decomposition. And the linkage was actually twice that of the nematodes in the nitrogen. If we look at the canonical correlation analysis on the left, there was, in the relatively undisturbed forests, the microarthropods explained over 40% of the rate of decomposition, which for a pretty diverse, you know, this is an experiment across three ecoregions with very different soils. So I thought this was amazing. How do they do that? Primarily fragmenting detritus as well as dispersing microbes. And the groups of organisms I have illustrated on here were the biggest players that weighted the greatest in explaining the variation. Okay. So now I want to show you a few successful examples of testing nematodes and microarthropods by land management practice or disturbance. First, I'll just quickly introduce a biplot idea. You saw one in Gary's talk, too. Slightly different idea. The main thing in a biplot you want to look at is the length of those arrows coming out and the angle between them. The longer they are, the more important in weighting. The angle, if it's acute, means they're positively correlated. If it's, you know, opposite quadrants, it's negatively correlated. If they're 90 degrees, they're not related at all. This is a study that I did in Toledo, Ohio. We had a pit of creosote, which was quite a mix of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And this pit was used for dipping railroad ties. We sampled at the point source and then along a gradient. And you can see the range of concentrations in the soil that we sampled. In the biplot, this canonical correspondence, which is a way to look at environmental versus biological organisms, I've illustrated the processes and the contaminant in orange, and the organisms are in blue. Notice in the upper right-hand corner where all of the chemical pollutants are, there are no organisms. All of the microarthropods and nematodes are down in the other quadrants. Okay, so what's going on? Now, I did interesting soil. The bacteria were the highest concentrations I've ever seen in my life. There were no fungi. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are fungicides, which I learned, and they also increase bulk density of soil. This soil, when you tried to stick your probe in, it felt like you're trying to insert it into rubber. in the highest concentration areas. So basically, I see that with the high, when we see relatively abundance of the microarthropods and the nematodes in this case in the lower left side, when we see those there, that's a healthier soil. It's less contaminated. We can see decomposition rate also aligned up in there. And I would say that in this effect, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon is only impacting decomposition indirectly by affecting the distribution and activity of the soil invertebrates by pore structure and or just relative toxicity. If we take this same kind of plot, different set of studies, I can look at cultivation and basically see the conventional cultivation and no-till situation in opposite quadrants, indicating there's, you know, negative association. We have completely different nematode communities in this case with no-till versus conventional till. And we see it similarly, this is with the cross-ecosystem study in North Carolina, we see it similarly for microarthropods, where we see different community composition in the cultivated versus the non-cultivated systems. Now, I wanted to add this too, just because it links in with compost, some great work done by Hannah Steele at Ghent University. And you can basically see that these indices, these successional indices of nematodes, also work for looking at the maturity of compost. So what we see on the left axis is that basically the ecological successional index, you could equally put in the maturity index or this ratio through time. And on that y-axis is basically right after the thermophilic period where we've reached the temperatures needed to kill pathogens. That's what's required by law if you're, you know, trying to have pathogen-free compost. And then after that time is basically the temperature starts to decline, and we call that process kind of the curing phase. So as those temperatures decline, and we also start to see colonization by other biological control agents, but also with nematode communities, the maturity increases with time. So it could be used as a metric for compost maturity. Okay, so I've been talking a little bit about references, thinking about, you know, cultivation and so forth. Another approach for agriculture, so that's a kind of a physical disturbance. I think another kind of reference we might think about would be just organic pest and nutrient management. And I kind of, the point about a reference, I think it's important to make sure it fits with the ecosystem we're looking at. And I picked these two because they are agricultural. I don't think it's fair to compare an ag system with a forest. You have to think of what the ecosystem type is. And I'm going to now delve into a little bit of work that just touch on the idea of, do we need to calibrate our indices differently for different kinds of ecosystems, whether it's ag, forest, or wetland, and at what spatial scale? Well, in the case for nematode trophic groups, ecosystems naturally vary in their community composition. For example, plant parasitic nematodes and bacterivores are notoriously abundant in agricultural soils. Omnivores tend to be more abundant in grasslands, and fungivores tend to be more abundant in forests. So on that, back to that North Carolina slide you saw in terms of the cross-ecosystem, eco-region study, that's what this data is coming from. What we look at here is the nematode community composition through time. This is a principal response curve, basically looking at, it's a multivariate repeated measures. The important thing to keep in mind here is that that horizontal line, the flat line, that's the reference. That's the relatively undisturbed reference. And then you see the sampling times on the x-axis. The line above that is wetlands. And the difference between the jagged line and that horizontal line is the difference in the composition of the community. And On the lower below that, you see two different lines. One of those is forests, and one of those is agriculture. Different. So basically, my take-home message from this is that we do need to at least, here for sure, wetlands, we need to do the interpretation is going to be very different than if we apply that indicator in forests and agriculture. And a collaboration that I had with NRCS and the National Agricultural Statistics Service, we did two region-wide surveys across two different states, and get a handle on, you know, some of the spatial variability, and one of the goals was what scale should we calibrate. Our conclusion was that we should calibrate at the scale of ecoregion. So ecoregion is still pretty coarse, but for North Carolina, there's three ecoregions, mountains, Piedmont, coastal plain, and Nebraska, there's also three ecoregions. And so we'd need some references for that. Now, I hope you're convinced that ecological succession indices have some utility, but there's still a few challenges that we face, in that the values that we put on there as a weight were based on best professional judgment and often morphological features. Many of them have not been tested empirically. And based on some metadata analysis, we found that there's some inconsistencies in those original assignments. So we have some genera of nematodes on the left, in the left column, and if they have a 1 under the CP, that would mean they would be a very early colonizer. If they had a 5 and tolerant to disturbance, if they have a 5 there, it would mean they're late successional and sensitive. What we found is where these check marks are, that those are genera actually behaved opposite of what we would have predicted. That the 3 that we thought should have been tolerant ended up being sensitive, and vice versa. So this kind of suggests to me that we need some independent empirical validation of these assignments. One approach that we've looked at is using DNA ADX as kind of a general biomarker of DNA damage. These are particularly sensitive to polycyclic organic compounds. If it is an adduct, it represents a bond a covalent bond between the chemical and the DNA. And if it is not repaired by the cell, it can lead to mistakes in DNA replication. And basically, if you can detect, it would take more cycles of replication to really get the same amount of DNA with an adduct than without an adduct. So you can measure that with like PCR, the polymerase chain reaction. We tested this on C. elegans, single worms. And just a nutshell of how it works is, we used a combination of extra long PCR, so 16 KB pieces, long pieces, so we had a higher probability of detecting damage, because we didn't have any clue of what gene it was going to, if there were any preference. So in the control gene, we see that if it's exposed or unexposed, blue and red, there takes the same number of cycles to make the same amount of DNA. This would be a case where it doesn't matter if it's exposed or not, there's no DNA damage, or it's very tolerant. This might be like a early colonizer. And the top, when we focused on a target gene, one that was related to apoptosis or aging, we saw when it's exposed to the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, that's in the red, we could detect adducts or damage because there's much less, it took more cycles to make the same, you know, to try to reach the same amount of DNA. So this could get tested across some different, intensities of contaminants. The one thing is it's only pollutant specific. It really only works for organics, not metals. But I think there's room for other types of general biomarkers that might be helpful. So as we look at the future, I think what we are faced with is we're coming up with tools now, and this is where I think it fits with the phytobiome, is tools that we can start to do. But we still have, some of these are at the identification, but we've really got to get it at the interpretation to understand what's happening ecologically. And somehow to get it simplified, enough so that more people are able to use these indicators. Right now, there's kind of a high barrier to entry. And like others, I wanted to just thank a variety of funding sources and many people that were involved in this. I'm just a member of a bigger team. I mean, one of the challenges is we're still at basic, since I think we're really at that interpretation calibration phase. And it's hard to say, here's a 3.2, that's exactly what that means. I mean, those statewide surveys, I can see what is the range without, no, you know, what kind of scale, but to really, we've got to link it with the ecological piece. I don't think it's quite at that point where you can just say, I've got a 3.2. And part of that also, I think a little bit of the noise is some of the taxa are more ambiguous than others. And if we can use a sentinel taxa approach and we could increase the precision of those two, that I think is going to help. You can certainly look at trends through time. I think you could definitely do that in terms of whether it's kind of if you're getting a more complex food web community or not, you can certainly see patterns through time. I think what I find is people like to think of it as like a fertilizer, like you can expect this much yield with that. And these things have a little bit more of a lag effect and a long-term impact. I know some of the farmers I worked with in Vermont, they know what's going on in their soil, and when they cultivate this more times, that it's the tilth is a lot, you know, that the community is a lot different. And we can detect it when we do sequencing. Doesn't quite answer your question, but I guess I still think there's a lot of basic research, too. I just wish I had an army of people to do it. Being a department chair doesn't exactly allow me to do a lot of research. I think it gives you feedback and relative to other sites. I think you've got to know about the management of what they're doing and making comparisons. It's kind of hard to, you can't really do it in a standalone, I don't think, all by itself. I'd be happy for other input too. Yeah. I think it's pretty close. There's definitely that transition that it's going to take before you see it. I can't tell you if it's exactly 3 or it should be 5, but to me, intuitively, it